Coming up on the show today, the pressure for a ceasefire in Israel is growing.
Israel now faces criticism over its full-fledged military response in Gaza.
Plus, the House of Representatives takes up aid to Israel.
In all honesty, this bill is a non-starter. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, has already said that it's not going to be taken up in the Democratic Majority Senate. And so, in a sense, this is just a first step, a bargaining chip as part of a larger discussion.
And later, Turkey, Iran, and Azerbaijan are seeing growing tension. And the group that told us all we need is love, the Beatles, have released new music. Today is Friday, November 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Israel has Gaza City surrounded. We'll hear from our reporter in Jerusalem in a few minutes. First, though, in the United States on Thursday, Senator Dick Durbin became the most powerful Democrat to call for a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. Though he did say it must start with the releasing of hostages, it's a sign that even centrists in President Joe Biden's party are feeling the political pressure or are just simply disturbed by the images of civilian suffering coming from Gaza. Meanwhile, the White House said it would support a pause, but not a ceasefire. Here's National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby.
Do we advocate pauses by both sides here, temporary, localized, to be able to get Americans out, to be able to get aid in? You betcha we do. That doesn't mean that we're calling for a general ceasefire. There's a difference. There's a big difference here.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is off to another trip to the Middle East, where public sentiment has also started to shift since his first visit immediately after Hamas's attack on Israel. The AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has this report.
After global sympathy, Israel now faces criticism over its full-fledged military response in Gaza, which makes Blinken's visit more complex. He'll again stress U.S. backing for Israel's need to defend itself, but
how Israel does this matters.
Noting images of Palestinian children pulled from the rubble of airstrikes.
That hits me in the gut as much as seeing a child in Israel or anywhere else.
Blinken says he'll discuss concrete steps to protect Palestinian civilians. He'll also introduce a new priority.
We're focused on the day of. We also need to be focused on the day after.
And the need for Israel and its neighbors to start considering what a post-war Gaza looks like. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
As the war between Israel and Hamas grinds on, some in Israel say it's time for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Senior Israeli officials have taken responsibility for allowing the unprecedented Hamas incursion. Among them, the defense minister, the head of the Shin Bet Security Services, and former chief of staff Benny Gantz, who wasn't even a member of the government on October 7th. But one voice has been conspicuously silent, that of Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Amos Asael is a fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute.
Netanyahu's record in terms of assuming responsibility since the events of October 7th has been a tragedy certainly for Israel, but first and foremost for himself. Leaders are tested in such moments, and his test was the basic test of assumption of responsibility.
At one point, Netanyahu went even further, tweeting that his security chiefs had assured him that Israel had deterred Hamas and no attack was imminent. The comments seemed to put the blame on Israel's security forces for not warning him. A few hours later, he deleted the tweet after public outcry and apologized in another tweet. A recent poll found that 80% of Israelis believe the prime minister should take responsibility for what happened. The poll by the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv also found that only 28% support Netanyahu as prime minister, as compared to 48% for National Unity Party leader Benny Gantz. Again, Amos Asael.
This will sooner or later end his career and also punctuate it. In other words, he's been with us as a national leader for just over a quarter of a century. In other words, since he succeeded Yitzhak Shamir as Likud's leader, and he's done many things and has had his fair share of successes and failures, all of them will be overshadowed by what happened on October 7th, 2023.
But Netanyahu himself says he has no intention of resigning. He is the only Israeli prime minister who has managed to stay in office despite being on trial in several corruption cases.
The only thing that I intend to have resign is Hamas. We're going to resign them to the dustbin of history. That's my goal. That's my responsibility. And that's what I'm leading the country to do.
Many Netanyahu loyalists from his Likud party say he will weather this storm, too. Boaz Bismuth is a member of Israel's parliament, the Knesset, for Netanyahu's Likud party.
When you're in the public service, it is, I mean, you know that you will also receive criticism. This is totally obvious in everyday life, in everyday time. So you can imagine after such a tremendous, enormous, unprecedented disaster. So criticism is totally understandable. And now there is a war to handle, and there is especially a war to win. And therefore, I mean, I think that the prime minister will be judged at the end of the war.
Israeli officials say winning the war in Gaza could take months. By then, public opinion against Netanyahu may have shifted. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
We've just heard an update on the political situation in Israel from Linda Gradstein. We've been keeping her busy today. She also spoke with VOA's Rick Pantaleo about military developments.
Linda, the Israeli military says in a TV interview on Thursday that it is surrounding Gaza City and deepening its operations there. What have you heard?
Yes, in fact, they say this is they're very satisfied with how the fighting is going. They say that dozens of Hamas militants have been killed just in the last 24 hours. They say that they are have a way to blow up all the Hamas tunnels, and they are sort of surrounding Gaza City, which is where they believe most of the Hamas headquarters are.
Israel's military says its ground offensive it had launched last weekend is advancing in the north of Gaza and that Hamas defensive lines are what they're calling collapsing. How is Israel's ground operations progressing?
Well, there's a lot of both airstrikes are continuing and, you know, really hand-to-hand combat is continuing. Something I think 18 Israeli soldiers have been killed so far in the fighting, but they say they have very good intelligence and they're moving forward. The question is whether Israel really intends to wipe out Hamas completely, and then also if there's really kind of an end game for what happens after Hamas is no longer controlling Gaza. And I think that's the part they haven't quite gotten to.
What about the hostage situation in Gaza? I know there's a lot of concern regarding that. And from what I've seen, the number of hostages believed to be held by Hamas in Gaza since the attacks on Israel are said to have risen.
The reason the number of hostages has risen is because there were still, and there still are, several dozen people that Israel didn't know their fate, if they had been killed or if they had been captured, and apparently has received, whether it's forensic evidence or intelligence evidence, that they have been kidnapped and are being held by Hamas. That 240 includes about 30 children and elderly people, and there have been so far 4 hostages released since they were kidnapped on October 7th. And there was 1 female Israeli soldier who was freed in an Israeli army operation. But that's just 5 out of 240. And for a lot of Israelis, the hostage issue is the number one issue on their agenda. You know, Israel's a very small country. Everybody knows everybody. And so the hostage families have been very active in trying to get both international pressure and, you know, so people don't forget about the hostages. As far as I know, the hostage families don't know whether their family members are alive or not.
That's VOA's Rick Pantaleo speaking with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Record-breaking winds in France and across much of Western Europe have left at least 7 people dead and several injured as a powerful storm swept through on Thursday. With winds of more than 190 kilometers per hour, the storm plunged vast numbers into darkness, devastated homes, uprooted trees, blew out windows, and caused travel mayhem in several countries. Indian opposition leader Rahul Gandhi accused Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government of trying to hack into opposition politicians' mobile phones after some lawmakers received warnings from Apple that their phones may have been hacked. And music fans all over the world are rejoicing at hearing John Lennon's voice again. A brand new song by the Beatles called Now and Then was released on Thursday. It was completed with Lennon's demo recording from the 1970s, assisted by artificial intelligence, combined with guitar parts written by George Harrison. Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, the two remaining Beatles, played bass and drums on the new track. Now and then, I miss you. The United States House of Representatives has passed a bill on Thursday night that would send aid to Israel. But it's where that money would come from, and it's what's left out of the bill that all but guarantees it will never pass the Senate. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent.
So what the U.S. House of Representatives is considering Thursday is $14 billion in aid for Israel. Much of that is defense funding going to bolster Israel's air and missile defense systems. And part of it will also go to humanitarian needs in Gaza for Palestinians. Now, what we do know is that this is a House Republican initiated bill, which pays for the aid by cutting the budget of the Internal Revenue Service, which is basically the U.S. government agency that handles the taxation of Americans. And because it makes those cuts, it's a non-starter with Democrats, even those Democrats who support aid to Israel and say that it's important to make sure that the U.S. honors that commitment to them. So in all honesty, this bill is a non-starter. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, has already said that it's not going to be taken up in the Democratic Majority Senate. And so in a sense, this is just a first step, a bargaining chip as part of a larger discussion over the White House emergency supplemental request, which is almost $106 billion and includes aid to Ukraine, aid to combat Chinese aggression, border security, and aid to Israel. So we are really just getting started up here on Capitol Hill.
Well, there's a lot to unpack with that answer. The first issue really is by taking money away from the Internal Revenue Service to fund that aid for Israel. Republicans, who have famously been budget hawks in the past, by taking away from the agency that brings money into the government, this seems to be going against their own philosophy, no?
By some accounts, yes. What Hill Republicans would tell us about this decision is that they feel that the Biden administration is incorrectly directing the IRS and that by making those budget cuts, they're cutting the Biden administration's priorities. Talk to Democrats and they'll say that this is merely a tax cut for the rich in disguise. So it really tells you how important a role the IRS plays in American life, because it really is how we bring in our revenue. And that tells you what each party wants to do in terms of funding priorities. So this is really a non-starter because the Democratic majority Senate will never take it up with those IRS cuts in there.
And another issue that it brings to the forefront is the division in the Republican Party over aid to Ukraine. By leaving that out of the equation, they're sort of pushing that can down the road, no?
That's right. The White House said today that aid to Ukraine absolutely has to be bundled with aid to Israel, as it was in their emergency supplemental request. The White House pointed out that the point of an emergency supplemental request is that you're saying these are urgent funding priorities to protect U.S. national security, And by delinking all of them, you're merely saying that one is more important than the other. I've also heard some explanations that it's actually more useful to make these defense requests together when you're going to ask for munitions for Ukraine and for missile systems for Israel to the same defense contractors. It makes more sense to, in a way of speaking, put those orders in at the same time, that it ultimately saves the U.S. money by doing this all together.
Now, there are some Democrats in the House who have come under fire for being, quote, anti-Israel, for being too pro-Palestinian. And does having aid for Israel in a vote like this put them on the spot to show a division within the Democratic Party?
Absolutely. You know, we have a progressive wing of the Democratic Party here in the United States and in the U.S. Congress that is very concerned, they say, about how Israel has conducted itself, who have made the argument that Palestinians have been placed in an impossible position with no rights of their own. And they argue that they should not be the victims of this war and that the money the U.S. is sending should not be going to benefit Israel. So we absolutely expect to see those progressive Democrats vote against this bill Thursday.
Last question for you, Catherine. You say this is dead on arrival in the Senate. So how does the process go forward? How will American aid get to Israel, to Ukraine, to the Palestinians?
Well, ultimately, what has to happen is for the Democratic majority Senate to make a deal with a brand new speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. Remember, Mike Johnson, the new speaker, has only been in this job for about a week. It'll be really interesting to see him go into what are some really tough negotiations about billions of dollars in aid, U.S. national security, U.S. defense priorities. These are really important questions that are facing the United States right now. And it's going to be very tricky to work out as they face a government funding deadline. Government funding expires on November 17th. And if they don't reach a deal on all of this, then the government shuts down.
VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson in Washington. Catherine, thanks for your reporting on this.
Good to be here.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Now, Iran's foreign minister visited Ankara on Wednesday amid a growing regional rivalry as Turkey seeks to expand its influence from the Caucasus to Central Asia. But for now, the conflict in the Middle East is providing common ground. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
At a press conference in Ankara, Turkey, Wednesday, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan both condemned Israel for its brutal military response to Hamas's October the 7th massacre in Israel. With Ankara increasingly challenging Iranian influence from the Caucasus to Central Asia, the Middle East conflict is providing a rare point of agreement amid rising bilateral tensions, analysts say. Columnist İlhan Özgel for Turkey's Kısa Dalga news portal.
Turkey is trying to connect itself with Central Asia. I mean, it's not a secret. So here, there's a growing tension between, I mean, simmering tension between Turkey and Iran. So it's kind of postponed because the attention moved to the Middle East again. But we're going to see it more and more in the years ahead.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is working to strengthen relations with Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan while repairing ties with Saudi Arabia, a Tehran rival. All moves that will stoke Iranian fears have been encircled by Turkey. But it's Turkey's deepening military ties with Azerbaijan, which has close relations with Israel, that is causing biggest concern, Selma Alice Warm. Soli Ozel is an international relations professor at Kadahas University.
Israelis have been cooperating with Azeris, Azerbaijan, to do lots of things in Iran, which actually made Iran furious.
In September, backed militarily by Turkey, Azerbaijan ousted ethnic Armenians from the contested Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Tehran strongly supports Armenia. Ahead of the Azeri attack, Turkish Foreign Minister Fidan warned Iran to stay out of any conflict. Some observers warn that Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev's victory is stoking Iranian fears about its own Azerbaijani minority, explains international relations professor Ozel.
Aliyev today appears as a hero because the Azeris for once won wars and stuff. And I think I'm sure the Iranians are concerned that the appeal of what Azerbaijani nationalists call Northern Azerbaijan may be increasing for their own population, for whom the unhappiness living under the Islamic Republic probably is rising.
During last year's nationwide Iranian protests, Aliyev, in a televised address, vowed to protect Azerbaijanis both in Azerbaijan and Iran. Azerbaijan and Iran have both held recent military exercises close to their border. Ankara, 2 years ago, signed an alliance with Baku, committing it to defending Azerbaijan in the event of war. With the Caucasus remaining tense and Erdogan Friday meeting with Central Asian leaders in Kazakhstan, observers predict bilateral tensions will likely escalate as Iran and Turkey compete for influence. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The most important element for successful development is democratic governance, said Milady Guiarte, Deputy Assistant Administrator within USAID's Bureau for Latin America and the Caribbean in recent congressional testimony.
Responsive and transparent governance and an independent judicial system allows people to have faith in their government. Without it, people often emigrate in search of a better environment, creating a vacuum of human capital that impedes a society from flourishing.
We work with the current Honduran administration in areas where we find common ground, and we engage in frank and open conversations about areas where we have differences, said Deputy Administrator Guiarte.
We welcome President Castro's commitment to establishing an anti-corruption commission, and we encourage both the government of Honduras and the United Nations to expeditiously reach a final agreement to implement a commission that will provide tangible results.
The United States has been disturbed by the high levels of impunity for attacks on environmental, labor, and human rights defenders, and the increasing rate at which women and girls are killed in Honduras because of their gender. The United States routinely raises human rights issues with the Honduran government and advocates for robust funding for the Ministries of Human Rights Protection Mechanism. USAID continues to work with the National Anti-Corruption Council, a Honduran civil society organization that has exposed corruption, said Deputy Administrator Guiarte.
This type of civil society oversight channels Honduran's demands for transparent and responsive governance. USAID has also worked with the Supreme Audit Institution and the Transparency Secretariat to improve access to public information and oversight capacity in municipal governments.
With regard to the economy, USAID has championed growth by working with private sector partners, including three of the world's largest coffee buyers who committed $109 million to connect 70,000 farmer households with global markets. That's more than half of all Honduran coffee farmers. And last year, as a direct result of USAID's assistance in these partnerships, the yield of nearly 18,000 farmers increased by about 30%, giving hope to many rural families. With democracy under threat in the region, it is critical to defend democratic values at all times, said Deputy Administrator Guiarte. For this reason, USAID will continue to put the Honduran people first, so families, communities, and the country as a whole can thrive and prosper.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.